Each separate floret and petal is an inscription speaking of hope. Consider the grasses and the oaks, the swallows, the sweet blue butterfly. They are one and all a sign and token, showing before our eyes earth made into life. So that my hope becomes as broad as the horizon afar, reiterated by every leaf, sung on every bough, reflected in the gleam of every flower. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann. BirdNote's newsletter delivers the wonder and joy of birds directly to your inbox. Sign up at birdnote.org to get a weekly preview of our shows, stories, photos, and more.
Hello, X-Ray listeners, and welcome again to Jazz in Portland. I'm Tom Skelly, filling in for Thomas Smith, to let you know of some events for this very busy week of April 20th. This is the week of the Mount Hood Jazz Festival. From the 22nd to the 26th, there are events at the Mount Hood Community College Theater and several other jazz venues around Portland. Monday, April 20th, at the White Eagle Saloon and Hotel, 836 North Russell Street, the Sugar Roots Blues Jam, 6 to 9 p.m. Tuesday, April 21st, at Pizzario, 337 East Main Street in Hillsboro, Laura Kennard's Live Jazz Jam, 7 to 10 p.m. Wednesday, April 22nd, at Rivaderci, 17023 Southeast McLaughlin Boulevard, Alto's Gone Wild, featuring Julie Hudenpyle, Barbara Ayers, and Julie Ermer, 6 to 9 p.m. Thursday, April 23rd, at Alberta Street Pub, 1036 Northeast Alberta Street, Zach Connolly with Marvin Matarang, Max Tucker, Marshall Peterson, Max Reynolds, and Thomas Theriff, 7 to 9 p.m. Friday, April 24th at Artichoke Community Music, 2007 Southeast Powell Boulevard, Anandi's Maiden, Oregon, 7 p.m. Saturday, April 25th at Sabor Latino, 1325 Northeast Broadway, Steve Christofferson with Laura Stillwell, David Evans, and Ron Steen, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Sunday, April 26th, at Al's Den, 303 Southwest 12th Avenue, Chance Hayden's Desert Room All-Stars with Sean Holmes featuring Richard Arnold, 7 p.m. Stay tuned for more info on Jazz in Portland and streaming online everywhere at xray.fm. Thanks for listening. Enjoy Portland music.
You're listening to X-Ray FM.
KXRY Portland.
At 91.1 and 107.1 FM.
And in Nehalem,
Wheeler,
Manzanita,
and Rockaway Beach.
At 91.7 FM. Streaming online everywhere.
Live and archived.
At xray.fm.
Radio is
Radio is yours.
Tune into Reverse Couple Skate Saturday mornings from 9 a.m. to 10 with your hosts, Aaron and Cheyenne.
Bounce rock, skate, and roll to the sounds of the 70s and beyond
on X-Ray FM.
X-Ray FM would like listeners to know about the Portland Urban Beekeepers, a local nonprofit dedicated to increasing education, advocacy, and awareness about beekeeping and preserving local pollinators. Did you know bees are responsible for one out of every three bites of food you eat? Portland Urban Beekeepers helps backyard beekeepers, engages through community outreach, and supports ongoing scientific research. More information at portlandurbanbeekeepers.org.
Hi, this is Alex. I am on the tech committee for the board of X-Ray.
You can know a lot, you can know a little, but whatever you know, just don't blow the whistle. Joshua Dean had a memory keen. He was strong and he ran every day, but his lungs turned to goo and he had a stroke too. At 46 he was sent on his way. Oh, and Swampy Barnett loved his mama, and he took a lot of pride in his work. He found 300 flute. You can play the fiddle, but whatever you do, just don't blow the whistle, alright? Boeing's got planes in the sky. Yeah, but Boeing's got men on the ground. Oh, you mess with the shiz, buddy, beware. They can make sure that you land safe and sound. They keep cutting their deals with the FAA, USA, fantastic lawyers of law. A little blip of the whistle cuts a bonus a little, but you can't never see what you never did saw. You can know a lot, you can know a little, but whatever you know, just don't blow the whistle. You can do the flute, you can play a fiddle, but whatever you do, just don't blow the whistle.
Is our old buddy Dr. Michael Mann, one of the world's leading environmental scientists, presidential distinguished professor of earth and environmental science, and director of the Penn State Center for Science, Sustainability, and the Media at the University of Pennsylvania, author of numerous books, including his latest, Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World, with co-author Peter Hortez. Michael Mann with two N's, .net is his website. And Michael Mann on Blue Sky, Michael E. Mann on Twitter. Dr. Mann, welcome back. It's always so great having you with us. I learned so much from you. We're looking at hotter summers, the longer summers, actually, a double El Nino, the great conveyor belt dying. Where would you like to start in this conversation?
Yeah, it's good to be with you. It's been too long since we've talked, and as you allude to, there are a lot of developments, a lot of water under the bridge, as they say, when it comes to both the science of climate change, the actual changes that are playing out, many of which are exceeding predictions. And of course, and this is what my latest book with Peter Hortez is about, the fact that our efforts to do something about it are running into an even greater obstacle here in the United States with this current administration, the Trump administration, that has a policy of climate inaction, of climate denial. We have, as Peter and I put it, there are really three challenges here. There's the climate crisis. There are the health challenges that you just talked about in your previous segment. And then there is this massive disinformation, much of it promoted by, right-wing media, plutocrats who have bought out social media platforms to promote anti-science disinformation that prevents us from acting on any of these challenges that we face.
So, let's start with the state of the world right now.
Yeah.
We've been tracking climate change for some time. I mean, I first wrote about it back in the 80s and 90s. You've been on this for a long time. The fossil fuel industry has known about this apparently since the 60s or 70s. But I saw a report recently that the speed with which climate change is happening, with which warming is happening, has dramatically accelerated in the past two decades compared to the previous two decades. Where are we at?
Yeah, so, what I would say is that the warming is proceeding almost exactly as the climate models predicted. We did see a surge in warming from 2023 to 2024. That was related to a very large El Nino event. And so if you actually look at the overall trend in recent decades, yes, there's been an acceleration because we passed the Clean Air Acts. So we stopped the production of sulfur pollution that was actually helping offset some of global warming by reflecting sunlight back to space. We smartly took steps to clean up the atmosphere, but that unleashed some of the warming that had been masked. So there was sort of an acceleration in warming following the 1970s, 1980s. But since then, actually, the trend is pretty steady. There are fluctuations on top of it, and the trend is almost as predicted with the models. That's the good news. The truth is bad enough. The models predicted that the planet would continue to warm as we continue to burn fossil fuels and elevate carbon pollution. And it has warmed, and it will keep on warming until we dramatically ramp down those carbon emissions. So, as I like to say, the truth is bad enough. The warming is more or less as we predicted it would be if we failed to act. Now, some of the consequences of the warming, and you've alluded to that, the potential slowdown and even collapse of the so-called ocean conveyor. There is some recent work that actually reaffirms some of our past work that suggests that this is proceeding faster than the models predicted, in part because the ice melt, the melt and the runoff of fresh water into the North Atlantic, which helps suppress the formation of deep waters that drives that overturning conveyor, that's happening sooner than we predicted. And these extreme weather events that we are enduring now, these unprecedented heat waves and wildfires and floods and superstorms, there are reasons to believe that some of the mechanisms behind these and these events, and our own research has sort of studied those mechanisms, aren't well captured even in the state-of-the-art climate models we use today. So those models may be under-predicting the consequences of the warming for these damaging, deadly, extreme weather events that we're now seeing. Again, the truth is bad enough. We don't have to exaggerate it to really emphasize the urgency of action. And as I like to say, it's equally important for us to emphasize the agency, that we can still do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Although this administration and, frankly, the entire Republican Party seems absolutely committed to not just not doing anything about it, but going in the opposite direction.
Exactly.
Do the climate models account, I'm assuming that they do, account for and to what extent should we be concerned about things like, rapid amplification? For example, the melting of the permafrost, releasing massive amounts of methane that might not have been accounted for a couple of decades ago anyway. Methane being, 27 times more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, if I'm remembering correctly?
Yeah, and more like 80 times as potent if you're talking about a couple decades. If you're talking about longer time scales, CO2 stays in the atmosphere longer. Methane comes out of the atmosphere more quickly. So on the in the shorter term, methane is a really potent warmer. Now, here's the thing. There has been an increase in methane concentrations in recent decades after it had sort of tailed off. And the best evidence is that that's actually coming from a combination of, fracking, natural gas extraction. Natural gas is basically methane, and when we attempt to extract it from beneath the surface, some of that methane escapes into the atmosphere. We call it fugitive methane emissions, and we know that's contributing to the methane buildup. We also know that that agricultural and livestock practices, rice cultivation, anytime you have sort of sitting water, standing water, that's a breeding ground for methanogenic bacteria that, put methane into the atmosphere. Big damming projects contribute to that. Livestock produce methane, cows, sheep, ruminants. And so agriculture and livestock is contributing to that. So far, the isotopic composition, we actually can look at the fingerprint of the carbon isotopes in the methane CH4. There's a carbon atom in there. And whether there's more of the heavier stable isotope, carbon-13, or the lighter, more plentiful isotope that we're familiar with, carbon-12, depends on the source of that methane. Different sources have different isotopic compositions. And so those isotopic studies suggest that thus far it's mostly coming from human generation. Now, if we warm the planet enough, there is a fear that we could destabilize enough of the methane in the permafrost along the shelves of the Arctic Ocean. There's a fair amount of methane that's currently frozen there that could be mobilized with additional warming. That's something we worry about. But thus far, we don't seem to be seeing that. That's the good news. The bad news is if we continue to warm the planet, then that could kick in too. So we do worry about these, you know, these tipping point like feedbacks. And one of those tipping point like feedbacks, as I alluded to, the slowdown or collapse of the conveyor belt, we seem to be very close to that now.
Yikes. Yeah, let's dive a little deeper into this, if you can stick around for a bit.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. We're talking with Dr. Michael Mann, the Presidential Distinguished Professor of Earth and Environmental Science and Director of the Penn State Center for Science, Sustainability, and the Media at the University of Pennsylvania. His most recent book, Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. Michael Mann, with two N's, .net is his website. We'll be right back with Dr. Michael Mann.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
He's also at Michael Mann with two N's on Blue Sky and Michael E. Mann over on Twitter. We'll be right back. And welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Michael Mann. Dr. Mann, you mentioned the mobilization of methane along the seacoasts. I'm wondering, you know, number one, if you could explain what an El Nino is and what this apparently is a massive El Nino possibly coming this summer. And does that bring even more warm water up against at the very, if nothing else, the Pacific, you know, the yeah. Pacific coast, the west coast of the United States? And what impact might that have on that?
Yeah, you know, El Nino events warm up the surface of the planet because there's so much heat buried beneath the tropical Pacific surface that if you sort of cut off the supply of cold water from beneath, then you really allow the warm water that is spread out over the surface across the Pacific. And the Pacific, the tropical Pacific, is a big piece of real estate. So when you do that, you actually elevate the average temperature of the planet by potentially, you know, 1 or 2 tenths of a degree Celsius. Now, why is that important? We're so close to 1.5 Celsius right now, 3 Fahrenheit warming of the planet, the level of warming where we fear we will start to see far worse consequences. And so the trend line hasn't yet crossed that threshold. It will in about a decade or less than a decade if we continue to emit carbon into the atmosphere. But on top of that, you get these short-term fluctuations. You get a big El Nino event like we did in 2016 or 2024, and you set new global temperature records because you've got that upward ramp of ever-continued warming as long as we pollute with carbon. And then on top of that, you get a positive fluctuation. And that positive fluctuation can bring you above 1.5 Celsius, at least for a couple years. And we've now done that. And once you do that, you can start to see some of those consequences that we worry about. Even a temporary rise in temperature, in the average temperature of the planet, starts to push us past some of those physical and chemical and biological thresholds in how, you know, living things and how our world responds to warming. So that is one of the things that we worry about, that those El Nino events at least temporarily push us above that threshold. Now, what we really worry about is when the trend line itself crosses that threshold. And like I said, without concerted efforts to decarbonize our societal infrastructure, we will cross that threshold within a matter of years now.
Wow. And how does this, we have about 40 seconds to a quick break here. How does this tie into the fact that most of the American West is in a massive drought right now?
Yeah, well, so in part, you know, La Nina years, the opposite, when the tropical Pacific is colder than normal, actually tends to be associated with drought in the desert southwest. And so El Nino might actually temporarily reprieve us from that, but the larger effect is climate change.
Yeah, and the climate change warming can't be helping the water situation, right?
No, we're drying out the West as we continue to warm the planet. We're changing the atmospheric circulation. There's drier air in the West in the summer, hotter and drier soils give us wildfires. So we are pushing the climate in that direction as long as we continue to pollute.
There you go. Stick around for another couple of minutes here?
Absolutely.
Okay, we're talking with Dr. Michael Mann. We will be back in 60 seconds. I have to read a commercial spot on the commercial side. You'll hear a promo on this side, and then we'll be right back. Stick around. Change starts with you. You can be calling your Democratic or Republican representatives to let them know what you think by calling 202-224-3121. It's the Capitol switchboard. It'll get you right through to them. So back in 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt became president, we were in the depths of the Great Depression. He raised the top income tax rate on billionaires from 25% to 90%. The ultra-rich were screaming, and here's what he had to say.
A number of my friends who belong in the very high upper bracket have suggested to me on several occasions of late that if I am reelected president, they will have to move to some other nation because of high taxes here. Now I will miss them very much.
He just took it right to them, right? Now, what came out of that was the world's largest and fastest growing and first major middle class. We can do this again. We just have to raise taxes on rich people. It's pretty straightforward. There's a whole article about it over at HartmanReport.com. Check it out. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Michael Mann. And Dr. Mann, I wanted to get into the AMOC, the Great Conveyor Belt here. A little bit. You mentioned it briefly, that there's this warm Pacific water that flows under along the surface, that flows under the tip of South Africa and up along the east coast of the United States. We call it the Gulf Stream. And then out in the middle of the Atlantic, it releases enormous amounts of heat, which keep Europe temperate, and then, you know, falls back down into the bottom of the ocean and recirculates back at the bottom of the ocean toward Southeast Asia or that region. And please correct me if I'm not describing this accurately. What is the meaning of this? Why should we care about this?
Yeah, no, that was a good description. I think when you said the Pacific, I think you meant the Atlantic at one point. And people do get, like El Nino is a Pacific phenomenon. It's a phenomenon in the tropical Pacific, and we know that's an important part of the climate system. And this AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, that's the technical term. It doesn't roll off the tongue, so we call it the AMOC or the conveyor belt, because it's essentially, as you say, this conveyor belt-like circulation that delivers warm waters. The Gulf Stream is sort of part of that, but most of the Gulf Stream is part of what we call an ocean gyre. It circulates. It goes north and along the U.S. East Coast, and then it sort of comes back south as you go out towards Europe and Africa. Uh-huh. But part of it breaks off and continues on into the high latitudes of the North Atlantic, and it brings a substantial amount of warm water. So as you say, if you shut that thermohaline circulation down. It's also called the thermohaline because it's driven by temperature and salinity contrast. If you shut the AMOC down, if you shut the conveyor belt down, we've got multiple names for it, then you cool off a large part of the North Atlantic. Now, part of why Europe is so warm is that it's on the west coast of the continent, so those warm, relatively warm maritime winter winds sort of warm it in the same way they warm Vancouver and Washington in the winter. Vancouver and Washington is a lot warmer than, say, you know, Newfoundland in the winter because it has the benefit of those relatively warm maritime winds coming off the ocean.
Even
that's part of
latitude.
Why Europe's warm. But part of it is the Gulf Stream, and if we shut that down, the main concern would be that we actually decrease the productivity of those ocean waters. That would negatively affect marine ecosystems, fish populations, and we would get more sea level rise, it turns out, along the U.S. East Coast if that circulation pattern collapsed. So it would be bad. It would be a bad impact on top of all of the other negative consequences of the warming.
You know, back in the, I want to say 18th century, I'm not sure exactly when it was, there was a period of a couple of years where there was basically a summer with no summer in Europe. And I believe it was a result of a volcano someplace, and it resulted in some famine actually happening in Europe. Could the shutting down of the AMOC, of the Great Conveyor Belt, lead to crop failures in Europe? Could this be that disruptive?
Yeah, so that was the year without a summer of 1816. It was a big volcanic eruption. And indeed, you had these very cold winters, very cold summers, in fact. Now, the same thing could happen in parts of eastern Canada and potentially parts of Europe as well. We wouldn't see anything like, you know, the movie The Day After Tomorrow, which is a caricature of what would happen if we were to see a shutdown of this circulation pattern. But we could actually see some cold winters, cold summers in particular, including Iceland. Iceland would be impacted quite adversely. It would be cooled down quite a bit. And so that is a consequence. I'll mention one thing, since we're talking about you know, the 1700s. You showed Benjamin Franklin briefly in your previous segment. Well, Benjamin Franklin, the founder of our university, the University of Pennsylvania, actually was the first person to chart the Gulf Stream. You can look it up. So we've got a pretty good legacy when it comes to climate and science here. He was also a major environmental advocate as well. And so we're proud of that part of our legacy here.
Right. Yeah, I get it. So we have just about a minute left here, a minute and a half. I thought that shutting down the Gulf Stream, shutting down that whole current, could be catastrophic. It sounds like you're describing it as merely inconvenient.
Well, it would be bad because it would add to sea level rise along the U.S. East Coast. It could lead to cool or even cold summers in places. It would impact the most productive natural fishery that we have on the planet, the North Atlantic. Those are the most productive waters. If we shut down that circulation system, we cut off the source of nutrients that feeds that ecosystem. And that would be catastrophic for a world, for a population of, you know, more than 8 billion people who rely upon fish primarily for their protein. 25% of people on this planet rely mostly on fish for protein, and we would lose a major source of marine life.
Fascinating stuff. Dr. Michael Mann, it's always an honor and a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for dropping by.
You too, my friend. Always a pleasure.
Back at you. Check out his new book, Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World, with co-author Peter Hortez. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour. I'll be back with your calls and the news of the day on the other side of the break. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
And, of course, Dr. Mann's website is michaelmannwith2ns.net. Snubs Trump's genocide threat. Gas prices gut the GOP. Vance eyes the 25th. Trump wants his own medal. Middle age cracks. And 2 minutes saves lives. Good morning. This is the Commonwealth Report, news for the public, not the powerful. Sign up for free. AM and PM News at commonwealthreport.news. Iran tells Trump to shove it after a genocide threat. Iran isn't playing Trump's game anymore. After the president threatened Sunday to blow up the whole country of 90 million people if they don't sign a deal by Wednesday, Iranian officials said they won't negotiate with an erratic leader. One official said Trump, quote, lacks both a coherent plan and the capacity to secure even a temporary deal. Trump claimed Iranian negotiators were flying to Islamabad today to meet with J.D. Vance, Jared Kushner, and Steve Witkoff. Iran's state news agency called that a media game. Threatening to bomb civilians and demolish infrastructure is a genocidal threat from the United States president and a war crime. Just the threat is a war crime. 67% of Americans disapprove of Trump's handling of the war. When a president threatens mass murder to save face, which is a war crime, democracy itself hangs in the balance. Is the White House about to crash and burn? The panic inside Trump's inner circle is real. Politico reports strategists close to the president are terrified rising gas prices will wipe out Republicans come November. One source warned, quote, if we don't see the $3 gallon of gas, we're going to get killed. Since Trump launched the war on Iran in February 28th, the average gallon has jumped more than a dollar. That's the biggest monthly spike since tracking began in 1967 under Lyndon Johnson. Gas is now $4.05 a gallon nationwide. Trump's own energy secretary, Chris Wright, admitted Sunday that prices might not drop below $3 until 2027. Iran's partial closure of the Strait of Hormuz is choking off a fifth of the world's oil supplies. Working families are paying for Trump's war of choice. They're going to remember in November. Will Vance stab Trump in the back to save himself? J.D. Vance is cornered. The Guardian's Simon Tisdale writes, the vice president's poll numbers are cratering and his 2028 hopes are crumbling. Tisdale calls Vance a, quote, crude opportunist, a self-proclaimed hillbilly peddling political moonshine, end quote. But Vance has one card left to play. Trump can't fire an elected vice president. Under the 25th Amendment, Vance could help fire Trump. A group of congressional Democrats wants him to join a commission that could do exactly that if Trump is judged unfit. Tisdale says Vance will bide his time, but Trump's Iran fiasco and unhinged behavior are eroding support. And that hurts Vance, too. Vance's lead over Marco Rubio for the 2028 nomination keeps slipping. When sycophants start plotting escape routes, the regime is rotting from the inside. Trump tries to pin a Medal of Honor on himself. Here's one for the history books. The Wall Street Journal reports Trump privately considered awarding himself the Medal of Honor, the highest military decoration this country gives. The man took 5 draft deferments during Vietnam. He never wore a uniform. Insiders say Trump panicked in early April after a U.S. fighter jet was shot down over Iran. He screamed at aides for hours, obsessed over the 1979 hostage crisis, and blamed the Europeans. Gas prices averaged $4.09 a day. Then he mused about pinning his own chest with the nation's highest military honor. Officials say he sometimes loses focus, drifting off to talk about the White House ballroom while soldiers die. A draft dodger dreaming up a medal for himself while the country burns? You can't make this stuff up. Why are middle-aged Americans falling apart? A new review in Current Directions in Psychological Science uncovered something deeply wrong in America. Researchers at Arizona State, Brandeis, and 2 German universities tracked adults aged 50 to 65 across multiple countries. Americans in that group are lonelier, more depressed, with worse memory and weaker grip strength than earlier generations. Meanwhile, folks that aged in Northern Europe are actually getting healthier and happier. What's the difference? Europe invests in families. Cash transfers, paid parental leave, subsidized child care. America doesn't. Healthcare here drains bank accounts. Wages stagnate. Adult kids can't afford to leave home. Aging parents need care. Income inequality keeps climbing. This isn't fate. Other wealthy nations made different choices, and their middle-aged citizens are thriving. We can, too. This suffering isn't inevitable. Could 2 minutes a day really save your life? Here's some really good news to end on. A new study from the European Heart Journal found that just 1 to 2 minutes a day of vigorous activity broken into short bursts lowers your risk of chronic disease and early death. Researchers called it VILPA, vigorous intermittent lifestyle physical activity. Sounds fancy. It's really just climbing stairs quickly, carrying heavy groceries, or hustling up a hill. Not a gym membership or a training plan, just moving with purpose. When you push harder, even briefly, your heart works, your muscles work briefly, and your mitochondria multiply. That builds strength and resilience. The older we get, the more we need intensity, not less. Avoiding it only speeds the decline we dread. So take the stairs, walk faster, your future self will thank you. And that's the way it is today, Monday, April 20th, 2026. I'm Tom Hartman. Share the Tom Hartman Program with your friends. Our podcast, The Hartman Report, is absolutely free and available wherever fine podcasts are available. And the entire three-hour podcast is available over at TomHartman.com. Human beings have a couple of unique characteristics. The first is that we can be very tender and loving and concerned and caring toward people we perceive as being our group, us. We can also be extraordinarily violent against people that we consider to be them, if we think of them or this other as a threat. Probably the classic example of this is Adolf Hitler convincing Germans that, you know, Jews were a threat to them and good Germans going along with the Holocaust. Well, this othering is built into our DNA. This is, you know, ancient stuff. And the Republican Party, since the time of Nixon, when he started, you know, picking up the white racist vote after Democrats laid it down in the 60s, the Republicans have been using this to try to other minorities in America as a political strategy. And this is really deadly stuff. There's a whole op-ed about it over at HartmanReport.com. Is othering human nature's deadliest instinct? Check it out. And picking up your calls here, what's on your mind today? Mark in Madison, New Jersey. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine.
I know the answer to this very well. You know, I'm fine with it. But whatever happened to no tax on Social Security?
Well, Reagan blew that up in 1986, as I recall, with his Social Security reforms.
Promise. No tax on tips, tax on Social Security.
Yeah, it's what they did is they put in a $6,000, I believe, additional deduction for people over 65 if your income is below a certain point or within a certain range. So only a relatively small number of people actually even qualify for it. And they're calling that no tax on Social Security because it only applies to people over 65. But by the way, it expires in 2 years, whereas the tax cut on billionaires never expires.
I have my 1040 right in front of me, and on less than $12,000 of taxable income, I owed a total tax of almost $4,000.
Whoa.
So if you want to go that route, it's like 33% taxable income on, you know.
That's crazy.
Tax on. Yeah, it's nuts. I mean, my overall income and my wife's income, it's about 10%. But still, there's no such thing as no tax on Social Security. It's a lie.
Yeah, it's the same thing with the no tax on tips and the no tax on overtime. They're highly qualified. There's all kinds of weird exceptions. The one on tips in particular is a scam because most people on tips don't pay income taxes on their tips anyway because they don't make enough to pay income taxes. Or if they do, it's a very, very low rate. And again, they expire in 2028, just like the so-called no tax on Social Security does. But the billionaire tax cuts. I mean, this was a sop. You know, it was let's just throw them a bone. The average working people, in order to get them to go along with or approve of or even support our tax. You know, cutting billionaires' taxes by $5 trillion. I mean, it's mind-boggling. Mark, thank you. Thanks for pointing that out.
I would have taken the bone. Yeah, I would have been happy to take the bone. Instead, this is the first time since I can remember that I've actually had to pay the IRS instead of getting a refund.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. Mark, thanks for the call. Dave in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hey, not too much, Tom. Hey, I wanted to bring up what I'm calling the Cauchy and Polly market effect. And I think and it's relevant to you.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about that at the top of the next hour.
Yeah, I was listening on CNN, and I forget the conservative they always have on there. He seems like a really reasonable guy.
Scott, what's his name?
Yeah, Jennings, isn't it?
Scott Jennings.
But anyways, yeah, I think so. And he was saying, he was right on the cusp of saying, because he said you guys were calling for World War III and gas prices are going down. You know, he's playing that game, and they call it catastrophizing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, the reason why this is coming out is because of Cauchy and Polymarket. And if I remember correctly, Don Jr. is a big investor in Polymarket.
Right, and he's an advisor to Cauchy.
Okay, and the problem with that sort of arbitrage is it doesn't take into consideration long-term effects or historical precedent. And the reality is, with Donald Trump and his administration, I think they are following it as well. And Joe Rogan, I think a lot of them are just following it as well. And what I'm saying is, here's how weird this could get, right? You remember Reza Pahlavi, the son Shah, of the Shah, right? Yeah, the son of the Shah. Like, it seems like they've abandoned this because, all right, look, it's not going well in the Persian Gulf, okay?
Right. I don't care. He's screwed himself. When we started bombing Iran, he thanked Trump for it. He thought that would get him Trump's support to install him in Iran. And instead, what it did is it just sabotaged all and the small base of support he had in Iran already. I think the guy's toast in terms of his political future.
Yeah, but Russia, he could solve a lot of Russia's problems. Russia could install him. Russia
in Iran?
Could say, look, America, yes. Russia could say America left a fiasco. They left just a burning cities in their wake, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, but he's a small-D Democrat. He wants a democratic transition. Russia is very happy with the theocrats. They, it's another dictatorship. They're all in on dictatorship around the world.
But Reza Pahlavi started backing off all this democracy stuff because it can't happen right away. The CIA knows all this, man. All this stuff Trump is doing is what the CIA did is they adapted the plan to satisfy Trump's political aspirations because Radcliffe over there at CIA said, look, this is all a fantasy. This is a fiction Trump created in his head. So let's just tell him, let's just not do a land invasion. It's impossible without a land invasion. See, Trump, it called the Kalshi and Poly Market, Trump was queasy. He didn't have a stomach to do a land invasion. It's impossible, Tom.
Yeah, I don't think it's Kalshi and Poly Market. I think he doesn't want to go the Jimmy Carter route. I mean, we had a couple of soldiers die in that effort to rescue the Iranian hostages. This is what Trump has flipped out about. But I get your point, Dave. I get your point. Well made. Thank you. Morris in Inglewood, California. Hey, Morris, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, who is the head of the Democratic Party right now?
Ken Martin.
Ken Martin. So it's not Kamala Harris, huh?
No. Pardon me, I'm sneezing.
Okay, I just recently heard her voice. She looked like she might trying to get back out there. Let me tell you something.
Oh, she's running for president.
Okay, well, she's got a whole lot of stuff to work with. The cost of living, they're going crazy, Tom. Mm-hmm. Well, our manufacturing been dismantled, okay? Remember when the Chinese didn't want to buy anything from the farmers? You think that was bad? Well, the Canadians got a monopoly on what is called potash, which is a fertilizer, right? A monopoly.
Potash.
If our farmers don't... thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. If our farmers don't get that, if you think we got some problems before, we're really going to be in trouble work, okay? Now, there's a guy by the name of... what's that fellow's name? Edward Davey from the United Kingdom. He said that Trump was a dangerous and a corrupt gangster. And that reminded me of something that Winston Churchill said in 1941 about Adolf Hitler. He said Hitler was a monster of wickedness. Sound familiar? Now, check this out. The talking points that the Democrats have to focus on is the cost of living. It's a nightmare. Manufacturing has been destroyed by Trump's tariffs. Okay? They're robbing. The Republicans are robbing the United States Treasury. Those are the talking points. Don't come outside of that, and I think we got this. What do you think, Tom? Am I tripping? Do I got something?
I think you're absolutely right, Morris. In fact, I would take it a step farther. I wrote an op-ed about this last week. I think that the main message the Democrats should be using is corruption. It's the corruption stupid. It's what Alexei Navalny used to try to take down Putin, nearly succeeded. It's what this Magyar guy used to take down Orban. The anti-corruption platform has historically been one of America's very, most successful political strategies, and Democrats need to adopt it and then use the data that you were just laying out as evidence of it.
Tom, you're smart. That's why you're on the radio. And by the way, the interview with Michael Mann, that was I'll get back with you, my brother.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Morris. Good talking to you. Don in Pittsburgh, Kansas. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Hi. This whole thing with the Straits of Hormuz, I mean, who can say they would have been surprised the Iranians would be involved in cutting the Straits of Hormuz.
Well, they've only been threatening to do it for about 200 years.
Right. They've certainly been threatening to do it ever since that Netanyahu's been, you know, militating to try and get us to attack Iran for
him. Oh, for sure, yeah.
And you know, you have to think, I mean, with Trump, you always have to figure out, is he really, you know, this is, you see different advisors. He's under the thrall of different advisors. And he has a knack for PR, but beyond that, he doesn't understand anything.
No. He's not very bright, is the problem.
No.
He's, you know, Netanyahu has been trying to convince American presidents ever since Bill Clinton to attack Iran on behalf of Israel, and Donald Trump was the first president who was stupid enough to say, oh, that sounds like a good idea. Let's go do that. And here we are.
Yeah.
So, you know, $6 gas, $7. Hey, I've seen $8 gas in parts of California.
Yeah, and now he's stuck, and he desperately wants out of this. He doesn't know how to do it. He doesn't have the brain power to do it.
Nope.
And
neither
again,
do the idiots around him, because he surrounds himself with people based on loyalty rather than competence.
Yes. Well, I hope that we can get out of this. You know, us and the Iranians and the rest of the people who live in that part of the world can get out of this with minimal damage, and that it helps.
Well, we've already got 6,000 or 7,000 people dead in Iran. You've already got 40,000 homes that have been bulldozed in southern Lebanon. It's just the death toll. 13 Americans dead, 500 in the hospital. 200 little girls killed in Iran in two different strikes on schools. I mean, it's just crazy, Don. It's crazy.
It's a debacle. It's a first class debacle.
It is, absolutely. Very well said, Don. Thanks for the call. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'll be back with more of your calls in just a minute. Stay with us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Speaking the truth, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin would really rather you didn't know all about. I'll be right back with you. And welcome back. Janet in San Diego. Hey, Janet, what's on your mind today?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Hmm? I'm calling regarding the letter that Dr. Bandy Lee and Jeffrey Sachs wrote today, or they're giving it to Jeffries, Schumer, Thune, and Johnson, regarding that Trump, because of his mental health, will escalate due to having a narcissistic collapse, that will override any caution.
Right. I had her on the program about this on Friday. It's titled Medical Concerns About President Donald J. Trump and His Fitness for Office. Spot on. What about
it? Right. And I think this just came on today on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know how much of it you had covered. So I was wondering how she's saying he has to be removed ASAP because we're in a state of emergency for our safety. So if impeachment takes too long and Article 25 takes too long, what would happen?
Well, those are the only two options right now that we know of. And her point was twofold. Number one, that Donald Trump's severe mental illness and his low IQ and competence make him a threat to the United States and the world generally. His narcissism, his being a psychopath, all that kind of stuff, his threats, you know, a threat to the world in terms of world peace. But also, pardon me, what I thought was most interesting was her argument that his particular type of mental illness is actually contagious. And that many of his followers, particularly his father's followers in Congress, have caught it, you know, and they're imitating his mental illness.
Yeah.
It's a big
shared
problem.
Psychosis.
It's a big problem. Mm-hmm. Janet, thank you for the call. Thanks for bringing that up. Janet in Long Beach, California. Hey, Janet, what's up?
Hi. Well, I would like to propose having a plaque. A Benedict Arnold plaque.
Mm-hmm.
With Trump's name on it and all of the January 6th rioters that he has pardoned.
Mm.
And proposed giving this to the presidential libraries. Maybe Biden would like to have it, and Obama, and maybe Pence would like to have it.
Or when the Democrats take over, hang it in the Capitol building next to the memorial. When they move that memorial for the soldiers, or for the police officers who were beaten and four of them died, it's right now in the basement where it's hidden. But if they move that into a public place, put it next to that.
That would be a good idea, and maybe to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Something to counteract all his praise of these people that he's pardoning.
He wants them to be the stormtroopers for his civil war, in my opinion.
Oh, my gosh.
I really think, that's what Trump did with the brown shirts. It was a volunteer, little mini army in the early years of Hitler. And, Mussolini with his black shirt, same deal. They started out as volunteers. They ended up as being, basically government employees who went out and beat the crap out of people who were anti-administration. Jeanette, thank you. Thank you. Great to hear from you. It's 49 minutes past the hour. I'll be back with you in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Hey, thanks so much for sharing our program and for reaching out to our stations and sponsors and letting them know that you're listening. It really means a lot to us. I have 8 suggestions for Democrats for messaging. Democrats seem to have a messaging problem right now. First, Democrats must frame the fight in simple moral terms. Don't be wonky like, hey, we need to expand social safety. No, say no child in America should go to bed hungry. Second, Democrats need to stop playing defense and instead seize the populist high ground. Like when FDR said, they are unanimous in their hate for me and I welcome their hatred. Third, ruthlessly define the Republican opposition and the morbidly rich broligarchs who own them. Fourth, tell stories instead of facts. Reagan did this with the black welfare queen. He had to lie about it, but we've got lots of great stories. That's number fourth. There's 4 more. And they're all over at HartmanReport.com. The title of the article is, If Obama Had Sent a Mob to Kill a Cop, Republicans Would Never Let You Forget It. And it's all about how Democrats can reinvent their messaging to start winning elections big. Check it out. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Picking up your calls here. Michael in Bronx, New York. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, good. All is well with you. So the terrible things that you and the previous great callers mentioned about Trump, and then he's still picking a fight with the Pope. He's still saying the Pope is wrong about everything, and he's soft on crime. Let's get a couple of things.
He said that the Pope said, Donald Trump said, and I quote, the Pope said it's okay for Iran to have a nuclear bomb, end quote. And the Pope literally never said that, never implied that, never even went close to that. So here you've got the President of the United States lying, which is breaking one of the Ten Commandments, about something that the Pope said. I mean, this is insane.
It is insane. And I was, Tom, you must have been reading my mind because I was about to get to that. Add to the fact, the blasphemous photos he depicts himself as Jesus. And this is the same guy who, mind you, is so obsessed with getting the Nobel Peace Prize. And he's going about all these acts that are totally opposite of peace. And you don't even follow the Gospels. How in the world are you going to say Pope Leo is wrong in everything he says, but who's the one that took theology? Yeah. It was Pope Leo. You never opened a doggone book in your life, Donald Trump. And here's a newsflash for you Trumpers out there, especially to you, Donald. Pope Leo would win the Nobel Peace Prize before any of you get your grubby, toxic hands on it.
Well, and it's not just Trump, Michael. Now you've got the vice president, whatever his name is this week, John Bowman or John Vance or J.D. Vance or whatever. Anyway, you got the vice president lecturing the Pope that, number one, he needs to be cautious when he speaks about theology, which is absolutely insane.
Oh,
and number two, that there's this thing called the just war doctrine. And that, you know, apparently the Pope doesn't understand it. Well, the just war doctrine was written about 1,200 years ago, or I'd have to go back and see how many, 1,000 years ago, more or less, by Augustine, right? And there's this whole group of, you know, within Catholicism, the Augustinians, and our current Pope was the leader of that group for 12 years. He's one of the world's leading experts on Augustine and the just war doctrine. And it's crazy.
And it was so bizarre. Also, he's going to tell the Pope to just stick with issues within the Catholic Church.
Right.
Wrong. Because people don't live in the church. They go there to worship. They still have to leave out. And they're subject to all the dangerous stuff that goes on, in which you, J.D. Vance, you, Donald Trump, and you, except, have... perpetrated.
Yeah, and the just war doctrine, by the way.
According to Pulp Fiction?
Yeah, according to Pulp Fiction, it's crazy. And the just war doctrine explicitly says you may not attack another country if they haven't attacked you first or are not on the very demonstrably on the verge of doing so. So we are not even, you know, our bombing of Iran is completely illegal by United Nations standards, by U.S. standards. I got to move along, Michael, I'm sorry. By the Catholic Church's standards. Brian in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. So, first off, I'm an unemployed tourism professional. I'm unemployed for the second Trump administration in a row, the first time.
Oh, is this because people aren't coming to America anymore?
Well, the first time I got passengers to Cuba for 4.5 years, I've told you about before, and Trump ended that in 2018. So Trump 1.0, I lost work. And then, yes, this time it's because no one wants to come to this blank hole country anymore. Tourism numbers are down big time. So.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. We discussed this before, once before. I remember, Brian.
We have. But the reason I called is because the number 13 came up to me today or yesterday. Someone was in the podcast and mentioned the number 13. Now, I haven't believed that the death toll of U.S. soldiers, I don't think that the death toll only is about U.S. soldiers. There's girls that were killed. There's many people that were killed. But the death toll, I haven't believed that it's only 13 for weeks. And we haven't had a new reported death of a U.S. service member for weeks and weeks and weeks. And Iran says they killed 600 of our people. Now, I'm not saying I believe like what Iran is saying or whatever, but so far they've been more credible than Donald Trump. But the number 13, why? Because in Afghanistan, withdrawal that was Trump's fault, more or less, that they try and blame on Biden, 13 people died. So I can almost guarantee, I don't have evidence, but I can almost guarantee that at some point there's a conversation that said, sir, we've now lost 14 people. We've now lost 60 people. We've now lost whatever. And Trump said, that number cannot go over 13. And you know, they said, but sir, we've lost more than that. That number cannot go over 13, period. Now I'm making up a conversation, but there's no doubt.
So his death toll in Iran is identical to Biden's death toll in Afghanistan that Republicans went after him for months over. Still do, for that matter. Great point, Brian. Thank you. Wow. We're hitting the top of the hour here. On the other side of the break, the insider trading suspicions looming over Trump's presidency. And could 2 minutes a day really save your life? Stick around. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
X-Ray FM is supported by our friends at Harka Architecture, whose mission is to uplift your ideas and our community. Harka brings expertise in toxicity, high performance, and resiliency to all their projects. They are a full-service architectural and interior firm specializing in middle housing infill, ADUs, remodels, and adaptive commercial reuse.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1853. That was the day that Harriet Tubman led her first trip on the Underground Railroad, the clandestine network that helped enslaved people escape slavery and move north to freedom. One of the most remembered conductors on the railroad, Tubman herself escaped slavery in eastern Maryland. Tubman had been forced to work in the fields, performing back-breaking labor under a brutal overseer. As a girl, Tubman was injured when she was hit in the head by a weight thrown by an overseer. The injury plagued her with headaches and visions that Tubman attributed as signs from God. To escape these harsh conditions, Tubman had to leave her family behind. But she did not forget them. On her first trip to free those enslaved, the group included her sister and two children. On subsequent trips, she helped lead her brother and aged parents to freedom. In all, Tubman made 19 trips back to the South. She became known as Moses, leading her people out of bondage. These journeys came at a personal risk for Tubman. Enraged Southerners placed a $40,000 bounty on her head. But Tubman was known to say,